takdir, küçücük sorumluluk var.
First, if you take photos of me, please do not put them in Facebook. Please, no photos of me in Facebook. Facebook is a surveillance engine. And if you put a photo of someone in Facebook, that gives Facebook an opportunity to do increased surveillance, further surveillance over that person, because it asks people to give the name of who is in the photo. And that way, Facebook gets more information in its database about the person in the photo. We could question whether putting a photo of your friend in Facebook is really the right way to treat your friend. But in any case, please don't do that to me. Second, if you make an audio or video recording and you want to distribute copies, please do so only in the formats that are favorable to free software. These are the OGG formats and WebM, in other words, not MP3. Thanks to the patent imposed on it by the Fraunhofer Institute, which is therefore no friend of free software. And not MPEG-2, not MPEG-4, and certainly not Flash. Any website that uses Flash deserves a complaint. And so please use the OGG formats or WebM, and please put on it the Creative Commons No Derivatives license, because this is a statement of my personal views. Now, I'd like to mention that outside, we have a bunch of stickers being distributed. They're gratis. We also have some software merchandise for sale, such as these buttons, which are €4, and these buttons, which are €2 with a GNU head, and various other things like t-shirts. We also have metallic stickers that say GNU/Linux inside. The idea is you put them on your computer, and we made them from metal so that they will not wear out. So, what is free software? Free software means software that respects your freedom and your community. So, it's free in the sense of freedom, not price. In other words, it's frei, not kostenlos. So, in English, we have to explain this to people. We say, think of free speech, not free beer. In order to understand the meaning of the word free in the expression free software. If you're speaking German, it'll be somewhat easier. You can say frei and don't say kostenlos, and it'll be clear. When a program is not free, we call it non-free, proprietary, user-subjugating software. Because that's what it does. A non-free program generates a system of unjust power. The developer or owner has power over the users through that program. So that program is really an instrument of unjust power. It's a form of digital colonization. colonization typically by companies, but like any colonial system, it keeps the colonized people divided and helpless. They're divided because they're forbidden to redistribute the software, and they're helpless because they don't have the source code, so they can't change it. They can't even find out independently what it really does to them. And often it does something nasty. And I'll say more about those nasty things in a few minutes. But what I've said about respecting freedom and community is very general. Too general. Let me say something more specific. A program is free software if it comes with the four essential freedoms. If you, the user, have these freedoms, freedom zero is the freedom to run the program as you wish. Freedom one is the freedom to study the source code and change it so that it does your computing as you wish. Freedom two is the freedom to redistribute exact copies to others when you wish. In other words, the freedom to help others. And freedom three is the freedom to contribute to your community. That's the freedom to distribute copies of your modified versions when you wish. If the program comes with these four freedoms, then it's free software because the social system of its distribution and use is an ethical system, respecting freedom and community for the users. But if one of these freedoms is missing or insufficient, then the program is proprietary software because it imposes an unethical social system on its users. Now, what does it take for these freedoms to be adequate? Well, in the case of freedom one, you've got to be free to actually use your modified version. There are devices that we call tyrant, which don't let users install different software. So you can, maybe they give you the source code, and you could study it, and you can change it, you can compile it, you can make an executable. The only thing you can't do is get that to run in the computer you own. That's why we call it a tyrant device. It refuses to run your version. Well, that's not having control of your computing. That's not being able to control the version you run. So that's freedom one includes being able to actually use your version in place of the version you got. In addition, these freedoms must apply to all activities in life. So for instance, if somebody says, this is free software for academic use, well, that's self-contradictory. It's not free software at all. If the freedom is restricted to a particular kind of user or a particular activity, that's not giving freedom to everyone, which is what free software means. But none of these freedoms is required. You're free to do these things, but it's not compulsory. For instance, with freedom zero, you can run the program as you wish, but that's not required. If you're a masochist, you can run it as you don't wish. You can also not run it. With freedom one, you're allowed to study and change the source code, but it's not required. You can get the program and run it exactly as you got it without reading one line. And that's what people usually do, because we're busy. With freedom two, you're free to make copies and distribute them, but you're never required to do this. You're free to do it when you choose. And with freedom three, if you've made a modified version, you can distribute copies of that, but it's not required. You can use your version privately. The use of a free program in society, well, actually, I forgot something. What you can see now is that the distinction between free and proprietary is not a technical distinction. It's not a question of what features the program has. It's not a question of how they work. It's not a question of how the code was written. Those are just secondary details. This distinction between free and proprietary is an ethical, social, and political distinction, which is why it's more important than any mere technical question. The use of a free program in society is development. A program embodies knowledge. In the case of free software, that knowledge is available for the users to learn, and then they can adapt, well, they can maintain, adapt, and extend the program, and they can also apply the knowledge in other ways. But the use of a proprietary program is not development at all, because it's dependence. Dependence imposed on one particular entity. Now, we all depend on society around us. This being forced to depend on somebody in particular is different. That's where it becomes an injustice. To write a free program is a contribution to society. How much? That depends on all the details. Obviously, a program that does very little and does it badly is not a big contribution. But at least if the program is free software, it's distributed such that it can contribute however much it has to offer. But a proprietary program is no contribution because it's a power grab. It's an intent to subjugate other people. In social terms, it's a trap. If it has attractive features, those are the bait for the trap. Their purpose is to attract people to fall into the trap and lose their freedom. So paradoxically, attractive features do not make the proprietary program better. They make it more harmful. So if you have a choice to write a proprietary program or do nothing, you should do nothing, because that way you don't do harm. Writing a proprietary program is doing harm to society. You shouldn't do that. Now, this is an artificial moral choice. In real life, you would have plenty of other options, which might be better than both of these. Probably some of them are. But if it were just these two, you should not write the proprietary program. Now, if somebody pointed a gun at you and said, write a proprietary program, then I would understand it. I would. I wouldn't expect you to sacrifice your life. But I would expect you to keep your eyes open for a moment you could escape. And to put in all sorts of nasty things in that proprietary program so it wouldn't work for the guy with the gun. So the aim of the free software movement is that all programs be free so that all their users can be free. But what makes these four freedoms essential? Why define free software this way? Each freedom has a reason. Freedom two, the freedom to help others, to redistribute exact copies when you wish, is essential on fundamental moral grounds so you can live an ethical, upright life as a good member of your community. If you use a program without freedom too, you are in danger of falling into a moral dilemma at any moment. Whenever your good friend says, that program looks convenient, could I have a copy? At that moment, you will face a choice between two evils. One evil is to give your good friend a copy and violate the license of the program. The other evil is to refuse your good friend a copy and comply with the license of the program. If you are in this evil, you ought to choose the lesser evil, which is to give your good friend a copy. Why is this the lesser evil? Well, if you can't help doing wrong to somebody or other, it's less bad to do wrong to somebody who deserves it. We can assume that your good friend is a good member of your community and generally deserves your cooperation. There can be exceptions, but this is the usual case. However, the developer of the proprietary program will have deliberately attacked the social solidarity of your community. That's very bad. So if you must do wrong to your good friend or the developer, do it to the developer. However, being the lesser evil does not make it good. It's never good to make an agreement and break it. Not even an evil agreement like this one, for which keeping it is worse than breaking it, still breaking it is not good. And if you give your good friend a copy, what will she have? She will have an unauthorized copy of a proprietary program. And that's a rather nasty thing. Almost as nasty as an authorized copy of the same program. It's not nasty for being unauthorized, it's nasty for being proprietary. So, when you have fully understood this issue, what should you really do? You should make sure you don't fall into the dilemma. I know two ways. One is, don't have any friends. That's what the proprietary developers have in mind for your future. No real friends. You can have Facebook friends instead. The other method, my method, is reject that software. Reject software that denies you freedom too, because accepting that software would mean betraying your community. If someone offers me a program, no matter how attractive it might be, on the condition that I not share copies with you, I tell them my conscience does not permit me to accept those conditions, so take your nasty program out of here. You've got to do that too. You must reject the software that asks you to betray your community. Reject software without freedom too. And likewise, reject the propaganda terminology that the proprietary developers use to demonize cooperation and sharing. Terms like pirate. When they call the people who share pirates, what are they really saying? They're saying that helping other people is the moral equivalent of attacking a ship. But in moral terms, that's as false as you can get, because attacking ships is very bad, but sharing is good. So let's not call them both by the same word. Let's not call sharing piracy. When people ask me what I think of piracy, I say attacking ships is very bad. And when they ask me what I think of movie piracy, I say, I like the first Pirates of the Caribbean. The point is, I look for a very clear way to reject the meaning, the propaganda meaning they're trying to put on that word, to show I won't go along with it. Please join me in doing so. Well, that's freedom too, the freedom to make exact copies and distribute them to others when you wish, essential on fundamental moral grounds. But freedom zero, the freedom to run the program as you wish, is essential for a different reason. So you can control your computing. Now, there are proprietary programs that restrict through their licenses even the use of the authorized copies. For instance, there is, or at least was, a proprietary program for managing websites whose license forbids using it to publish anything that criticizes the program's developer. In this case, proprietary software literally takes away the user's freedom of speech. Clearly, if you can't even freely use the copy you're supposed to use, you don't have control of your computing. Freedom zero is essential. But it's not enough, because that just means you can either do or not do whatever the code of the program is already set up to know how to do. Which means the developer continues imposing his decisions on you, not through the license if you have freedom zero, but rather through the code itself. So, in order to have control of your computing, you need freedom one, which is the freedom to study the source code and then change it so the program does your computing the way you wish. That way, you decide what it does when it runs, instead of letting him decide for you. If you don't have freedom one, you can't even tell what that program does. And it might very well do something nasty. Many proprietary programs are known to have malicious features designed not to serve the users, but rather to spy on the users, restrict the users, and there are even back doors to abuse them. And this is not a rare danger. There are many rare dangers in life, bad things that could happen, but probably won't happen to you today, or even this year. This is not one of them. This is the usual case. Almost everyone running proprietary software is running proprietary malware, that is, programs with known malicious features. I'm not talking about speculation here, I'm talking about malicious features that have been described and documented. For instance, one proprietary package that does all three of these malicious things that you may have heard of is called Microsoft Windows. Windows is malware, literally. Because it has known surveillance features that transmit information about the use of the computer to a server. It has known digital handcuffs, which are the features that restrict what users can do with the data in their machine. And this is not just the lack of a feature. This is an intentional restriction carefully implemented in order to restrict users. We also call it, this kind of thing, digital restrictions management, or DRM. And Windows has known back doors. One of them allows Microsoft to remotely install software changes without asking permission of the nominal owner of the computer. I say nominal because in practice, once Microsoft has Windows running in that computer, Microsoft has owned that computer. So this is a universal backdoor, because any malicious feature that is not present in Windows today could be remotely installed by force tomorrow. So Windows is universal malware. But it's sad to say, not unique. The Macintosh system is malware because it has digital handcuffs. And although we don't know of any backdoor that allows Apple to forcibly change the software, Apple has offered users upgrades that they couldn't refuse, which comes to almost the same thing, telling them that their access to various services would break if they didn't install the upgrade designed to restrict them. And then if we look at Apple's newer computer products, the iThings, those are the nastiest. They're pioneers in mistreating the user.
I bet.
That's why we made the iBad. It says iBad, bad for your freedom. People have found at least two surveillance features in the iThings in the past year or so. They have the tightest digital handcuffs ever because Apple seized control even over the installation of applications. The users can't freely choose what programs to install on top of the operating system. They can only install the programs that Apple has approved. In other words, Apple practices censorship of applications, and its censorship is arbitrary and strict and nasty. And when users find ways to break this particular part of the handcuffs, they call it jailbreaking, which term recognizes that these computers are designed to be jails for their users. That was the evil genius of Steve Jobs. He figured out how to design computers to be jails for their users and convince millions of people to beg and line up in long queues to be jailed. And then there's the back door, which Apple can use to remotely deinstall applications. And therefore, Apple operating systems are malware. Then there's Flash Player. Flash Player is gratis, but it's not free. And it has a surveillance feature and digital handcuffs. Now, many people mistakenly think of Flash Player as free just because it's gratis. But really, does it matter that it's gratis? What difference does that make? That means that Adobe does not make users pay to be abused. So if you made the mistake of installing this non-free program, Flash Player, delete it immediately. Then there is the PlayStation 3, which was designed, it had the same kind of digital handcuffs as the iThings did later, because this started with game consoles. Apple pioneered it in general purpose computers. But when somebody figured out a way to jailbreak the PlayStation 3, Sony sent the police after him, which is why we call for a total boycott of all Sony products. Then there is the Amazon swindle. A so-called e-book reader, which swindles readers out of the traditional freedoms that readers have enjoyed. For instance, there's the freedom to buy a book anonymously, paying cash, which is the only way I will buy a book. I make sure that no database gets information about what book I bought. So I might conceivably pay with a credit card if I had no cash, if it was a bookstore that's old-fashioned enough that it doesn't have a computer taking note of what the books are. But that's impossible with the swindle, because the only place to get most books is from Amazon, and Amazon will not let users pay cash. There's no way to buy anonymously. Users are required to identify themselves. which means that Amazon manages a gigantic list of all the books that each user has read. And the existence of such a list is a threat to human rights. It should not be allowed. Then there's the freedom to give the book to someone else after you read it, or to lend it to someone else, or to sell it after you read it. Amazon eliminates these freedoms with digital handcuffs, together with end-user license agreements that say users are not allowed to give, lend, or sell the books. In effect, Amazon does not respect private property. Amazon's idea of private property is like Microsoft's idea of private property. Everything belongs to us. But that's not private property. Private property means that you can have some also. And then there's the freedom to keep a book as long as you like, and perhaps pass it on to your heirs. Well, Amazon eliminates that freedom with a back door in the swindle. We know about this back door by observation. So we don't know all the things it can do. We only know what we've seen it used to do. We've seen it used to remotely erase books. In 2009, Amazon remotely erased thousands of copies of a particular book. Until that day, those copies were authorized. They had been obtained by the users from Amazon in the usual approved way. And then one day Amazon said, these copies are no longer authorized, poof. I met somebody who said he was reading his copy when it disappeared. Sounds Orwellian, huh? You want to guess which book it was? It was 1984 by George Orwell. There was a lot of criticism of Amazon for this, so Amazon said it would never do this again unless ordered to by the state. Which, if you've read 1984, you will not find very comforting. So you should all read 1984, but not on the swindle. The official name of that product is the Kindle. Kindle means to start a fire, which might be a hint that it's designed to burn our books. And then my last example is most portable telephones have software with malicious features. You know, even if it's not a smartphone, even if it doesn't offer you the chance to choose any software, it's full of software and a company can remotely change the software. In other words, it has a universal back door. And it has a surveillance feature that will send your location based on GPS on remote request. And probably doesn't let you turn that off. So this is a surveillance feature and a back door. And the back door has been used to remotely convert phones into listening devices, which transmit all the conversation that they hear. And so that, which means you don't have to speak into the microphone for it to be listening to you. You just have to be in the same room talking. When I found out what portable phones did to their users, I concluded that they are Stalin's dream. That's why I don't have one. Well, in any case, the examples I have just listed are used by, nearly everyone that uses proprietary software is using at least one of these things. So this proves that nearly every user of proprietary software is using proprietary malware. This is not a rare danger, it's the usual case. But how did it get to be the usual case? Why is it that these, again and again we find that a widely used proprietary program is malware? It's because power corrupts. The developer of a proprietary program without Freedom One knows what power he has and feels the temptation to take advantage of it by putting in these malicious features. He knows the users can't remove malicious features from proprietary software if they don't have Freedom One. So the temptation is tremendous. And when this entity is in fact a psychopath, such as a corporation, then what do you expect? But with free software, you don't find malicious features because the users can remove them. So the developers know that they don't have power. So they don't feel, they don't face a similar temptation. And even if some developer did put in a malicious feature, if the users start to suspect it might be there, they can look for it and they can fix it and they can protect themselves. Now, I've cited some well-known proprietary programs. There are thousands of other proprietary programs without Freedom One. And I don't know whether they have malicious features or not. We can't check. So we must treat them as potential malware. We don't know if they're malware or not, and we can't find out. The developer is preventing us from checking. The same developer that's the one that could have put in malicious features, perhaps, is preventing us from finding out if they're there or fixing them if they are. Well, this is reason to treat it with suspicion. Any program without Freedom One must be considered potential malware. But even if the program does not in fact have any malicious features, it surely has bugs. Because their developers are human, so they make mistakes. So those mistakes are bugs. And the user of a program without Freedom One is just as helpless facing an accidental error as facing an intentional malicious feature. If you use a program without Freedom One, you're a prisoner of the program. We free software developers are human too, so we also make mistakes. Free programs have bugs too. In fact, any non-trivial program has bugs. But if you find a bug in our free code, or anything in the code you don't like, you are free to change it, because we did not make you our prisoner. We can't be perfect. We can restore your freedom. So Freedom One is essential. But it's not enough. Because that's the freedom to personally study and change the source code, or to do so inside one organization. Now, that's not enough, because there are millions of users that don't know how to program. They don't know how to exercise Freedom One. But even for programmers, Freedom One is not enough, because any programmer is busy doing a few jobs and doesn't have time to do everything else. In fact, there's so much software in the world. There's so much free software already in the world that no one user could possibly study and master the source code of all the programs she uses, nor personally write all the changes she might want, because that's more work than one human being is capable of. So the only way we can fully have control of our computing is to do it together, cooperating. And for that, we need Freedom 3 as well. The freedom to distribute copies of your modified versions. The freedom to contribute to your community. First of all, this means that if several users of a free program want to work together in making changes, they can do it because they can distribute their changed versions to each other and thus work together. And when they have a version they think is good, they can also, with Freedom 3, publish that version. And then everybody gets to use it or not, as he prefers. And this way, If they make an improvement, all the users can have it. Even the users that don't know how to program can have it. And if they saw anything malicious in this free program, they could publish a non-malicious version, one where the malicious feature is removed, and they would announce this, and it would be a tremendous scandal, and everyone would hear about it, everyone would switch to this version, and the malicious feature would be gone. So with free software, we have a defense. The users of proprietary software are defenseless. Now, without Freedom 3, yes, each of us would be individually free to make the same change. But what a waste it would be to write this change millions of times. And all the users that don't know how to program, they couldn't write it. They would be left out. That's not good enough. So Freedom 3 is essential. With Freedom 3, the users control their computing both individually and collectively. In any group of people that choose to work together, that group has control over the version it works on. And thus, the four freedoms together give us democracy. A free program develops democratically under the control of its users. Because every user is free to participate as much or as little as she wishes in society's decision about the future of that program, which is simply the sum total of the decisions that users make about what to do with it. I'd like some water with no gas. If someone could possibly... Thank you. And is there a way to increase the ventilation? It's terribly hot in here. Doors be opened?
That's not doors, actually.
They're not doors. They look like they're doors.
It's windows.
It's prison. Bastards.
Wohin damit? Hier hin?
Well, I guess the question is, how long is the alarm likely to be, and is it likely to interfere with the talk more than the heat does? Has any of you ever heard this alarm? Well, I hope this will help. Maybe we need to open a door to the outside over there so that we can get an air current. In any case, where was I? Oh yeah, I was talking about how a free program develops democratically under the control of its users. By contrast, a proprietary program develops under the sole and total power of its owner. So it's autocracy instead of democracy. Ultimately, with software, there are only two possibilities. Either the users control the program, or the program controls the users. The software that's controlled by the users is free software, because with the four freedoms, the users control the program. The four freedoms are essential because those are the freedoms users need to have effective control over what the program does when they run it. But if the users don't control the program, then it's the program that controls the users. And it's the owner that controls the program, and this non-free program is therefore an instrument of unjust power. And that's why non-free software must not exist. Society has a choice to make. On one side, we have individual freedom, social solidarity, and democracy. On the other hand, we are subjugated by the autocratic power of the program's developer. Society must reject proprietary software and choose free software. The ultimate goal of the free software movement is the liberation of cyberspace and all its inhabitants. We invite you to escape from proprietary software and come to the free world that we have built. Come and live with us in freedom. Well, that's nice as a theoretical goal. How do we achieve it in practice? In 1983, I noticed that it was impossible to buy a computer and use it in freedom. All the operating systems for modern computers at the time were proprietary, and the computer isn't usable without an operating system. So when you bought a new computer, to make it usable, you had to have a non-free operating system installed, and there went your freedom. I wanted to change that, but I was just one man, without much money, without much fame outside of the users of Emacs. And those were probably not more than a few thousand. And few people agreed with me. This meant that we wouldn't achieve much with a classical political movement protesting in the streets or sending letters to officials. And I had no experience doing that sort of thing anyway. I was not a political organizer. I was an operating system developer. But as an operating system developer, that meant there was another way I could achieve this goal. All I had to do, thank you, was write an operating system. Then, as the author, I could make it free software legally. Then, everybody would be able to use their computers in freedom by running my system. In other words, I could give people a way to escape from this injustice by doing technical work in my own field. I was aware of the injustice of proprietary software, which most people did not recognize as an injustice. I had the technical skill necessary to try to enable people to escape from this injustice. And it looked like nobody else was going to try, if not me. That meant I was elected by circumstances to do this work. It was my duty. It's as if you see somebody drowning, and you know how to swim, and there's no one else around, and it's not Bush. Then you have a moral duty to save this person. Well, perhaps that statement is too strong. After all, Obama is not very different from Bush. He protects torturers. Maybe we could identify a lot of people about whom I shouldn't make the claim that you have a moral duty to save them. However, I don't need to resolve all those questions because I don't know how to swim. However, in the real situation in my life, the work to be done was not swimming, it was writing lots of code. That I knew how to do. So I decided to develop a free software operating system, which means a system which would be entirely made up of free software. Every piece would be free software. Not one line of non-free software would be in this program. That's the point. Every piece would respect your freedom, so nothing in the system would take away your freedom. That's the criterion that's necessary for users to still have their freedom. And then I decided to recruit others to help to finish it sooner. Then I decided to make it a Unix-like operating system, partly so it would be portable, that is, so it could adapt to future computer models that might appear, even though they would be different. And also to make it compatible with Unix, so that the many users of Unix at the time would find it easy to switch. And then I gave it a name which is a joke. The name of the system is GNU, spelled G-N-U. And this is a joke because it's a recursive acronym. GNU stands for GNU's Not Unix. Now, programmers love jokes involving recursion. But in order for it to be a joke, it needs another meaning. Why GNU and not ANU, FNU, SNU? Well, they're not words. GNU is a word. GNU is the name of this animal. Is the name of this animal that lives in Africa. So, given two meanings, it was a joke. But it's much better than that. You see, GNU is the most humor-charged word in the English language, used in countless wordplays, because according to the dictionary, the G is silent and it's pronounced new. So every time you want to write the word new, instead of spelling it N-E-W, you can spell it G-N-U and you've got a joke. Perhaps not a very good joke, but there are lots of them. So we have been conditioned to associate this word with humor. You just see the word GNU and you're almost ready to laugh. Given a specific meaningful reason for using this as the name of a programming project, I couldn't resist. But when it's the name of our system, please do not follow the dictionary. Please do not say the new system, because that's not true. We've been developing it for over 28 years and using it for over 20 years, so it's not new anymore. So please pronounce it GNU. It's not new, but it still is GNU, and it will always be GNU. So don't follow the dictionary when it's the name of our system. There's another pronunciation error that is incredibly common and utterly bizarre. People talking about the GNU system pronounce the name Linux. How did such a bizarre error get started? Well, what happened is a confusion at just the wrong moment. We started working on the GNU system at the beginning of 1984. By 1990, we had almost all the components necessary. Well, how did we get them? Well, I wrote some of them. Some of them I recruited other people to write. In some cases, I convinced someone to liberate a proprietary program. For instance, at Berkeley, BSD existed in 1984. It was proprietary. It was a modified version of Unix, including a lot of code from Unix and a lot of other code. And it was all distributed as proprietary software. So I went to the developers at UC Berkeley and I said, why are you donating all your work to AT&T? Would you please separate your code from the AT&T code and release your code as free software? I asked them this because I knew they had some components that I hope to be able to use in the GNU system. Well, a few years later, they started doing this. And then in some cases, a free program was developed by some other project for some other purpose. Now, those projects did not aim to make a free operating system, but they wrote some piece of free software that was useful in a free operating system. So we used it. So putting all these things together, by 1990, we had almost everything, but one major essential component was still missing. That was the kernel. The kernel is the component of an operating system that the other programs run on top of, and it allocates the machine's resources to them. We started developing a kernel, the GNU Herd, which I believe has been described to some extent already, in 1990. The Free Software Foundation hired a programmer to write it. I chose the in a very general way, the design. And it seems to have been too advanced and elegant, and it made the thing a research project, and it took us 6 years to have a test version. And it's still, you know, you can run it, but it needs a tremendous amount of work to be competitive. Well, that's sad, but it was not a disaster, because in 1992, Mr. Torvalds, who had started a proprietary kernel called Linux in 1991, in 1992, he liberated it. He released it as free software under the GNU General Public License. Now, the GNU GPL is not the only free software license. There are dozens of different free software licenses. Sometimes it's inconvenient that there are so many, but the GPL is the most commonly used one. Anyway, once he made Linux free software, the combination of the almost complete GNU system and Linux made a complete free operating system, which was basically the GNU system. But it also had Linux, which was not part of the GNU system. We didn't expect to use Linux. We thought our kernel would be working any day now. So other people put Linux together with the hundreds of pieces, big and small, that were going to be the GNU system. And they made this combination, but they didn't realize it was mostly the GNU system. They were so focused on the kernel Linux that they perceived all the rest as a small add-on, and they didn't realize it was GNU that they were adding to Linux. So they started calling this combination a Linux system, which was quite unfair to us. Really, it was a variant of GNU. It's GNU plus Linux. So please give us equal mention. Please call the system GNU slash Linux or GNU plus Linux. It's not nice to give none of the credit to the system's principal developers. But it's true that credit is not the most important ethical issue in life. If it were just a matter of credit, it wouldn't be really important. But there's something much more important at stake in your choice of name to use for this system. Your freedom is at stake. Indirectly, of course, because directly the name doesn't change the thing. If you call roses onions, that won't change the roses. But it will get cooks confused. Because the mother will send the child to go to the store and get some onions. The child will come back with these things that don't look or taste like onions. And in the long term, you might change the roses, because the people who grow roses might start breeding roses that smell and taste like onions for the sake of these confused cooks. That would be most unfortunate. What a sad thing it would be if roses smelled like onions. I really enjoy nasal sex with plants, but I wouldn't want to have nasal sex with a rose bush whose flowers smelled like onions. So it makes a difference which words you use. Since 1983, the name GNU has been associated with our ideas of freedom and community. The name Linux is associated with different ideas, with the ideas of Mr. Torvalds. And what are they? Well, he doesn't believe, he doesn't support the free software movement. He disagrees. He doesn't believe that users like you deserve freedom in your use of software. He doesn't believe that he deserves freedom in his use of software. He says that what he values is powerful, reliable, convenient software. In other words, practical convenience values rather than ethical values, a totally different philosophy. He has the right to his views. He doesn't have the right to cite our work as if it were his work in order to have a bigger platform to oppose our views, which is what in fact happens. When people think the system is Linux, they think it was started by him in 1991. They think it all comes from his worldview, and they tend to admire him tremendously, and so they imitate his political and ethical ideas too, which means they don't learn to value their own freedom. So it's important to call the system GNU/Linux. You see, freedom is frequently threatened. To keep it, we have to defend it. That's true in all areas of life and has been for a long time. But in order to defend your freedom, you have to value freedom. In order to value freedom, you have to have the concept of freedom. In other areas of life, the debate about human rights has gone on for decades or centuries, which means plenty of time to reach conclusions about the rights that every person deserves and to spread them around the world. And they provide a base for defending and recovering human rights. But computing is a very new field. It's only 20 years since most people, even in advanced countries, started using computing. Less than 20 years, actually. And in the rest of the world, it's much less than that. So this is not a lot of time to have the debate about what human rights a person deserves in using software. But in fact, there has mostly been no debate. You see, nearly everyone started using computers with proprietary software, surrounded by other users of proprietary software. That's all they knew about. So they took for granted that proprietary software was legitimate, which means, in effect, they let the proprietary developers dictate the answer to that question. What human rights do you deserve in using a program? And their answer was, basically none at all. And people, for the most part, have accepted that. Except for us in the free software movement. We say that we've identified four human rights that every user deserves. Those are the four essential freedoms that define free software. But when we try to spread our ideas and bring them to the attention of, for instance, the users of the GNU system, most of them say, why should I read this? This comes from those GNU extremists. And I'm a Linux user. I admire the pragmatic ideas of Mr. Torvalds. I won't bother with that. This is ironic, because when they say, I'm a Linux user, what they mean is they're using the GNU system with Linux. But they don't know that. If they knew that, they might reach a different conclusion. They might say, I'm a GNU plus Linux user, and these are the ideas of the GNU project. I'd better pay attention. And then we would have a chance to convince them, which is, after all we can ask for, a chance to convince them. You can help us have that chance by teaching them that the system is GNU plus Linux. It's not Linux. Linux is one piece. And it was started in 1984 by people who wanted to win freedom for the users of computers. Now, if people know this much, and they use the system, they will see why it's worth paying attention to the reasons for which we develop the system they use. We'll have a chance to convince them. But today, there's another obstacle. Today, most of the people who hear about this system and other free software don't hear the term free software, because they see it described by a different term, one that I never use, quote, open source, unquote. And why is this? The people who use the term, quote, open source, unquote, do so because they don't want to talk about freedom or ethics. They want that level of the issue to be forgotten. So, of course, they don't want to say free. During the 1990s, as GNU/Linux spread, a lot of people, typically it was spreading among programmers and sysadmins and so on. Well, a lot of them discovered that the system had a number of practical advantages. It was powerful, reliable, efficient, flexible, cool, and cheap. And so they recommended it to their friends, but they didn't talk about freedom because they hadn't heard those ideas. So, there were two political camps within the free software community. There was the free software movement with ideas like what I've told you today, and then there was the other camp, the people who appreciated the free software and contributed to it, some of them, but only for other reasons, and they didn't see it as a question of justice versus injustice. And there was a debate between the two camps, so anyone coming into the community would get to see that our camp existed. But in 1998, the people in that other camp coined the term open source so that they wouldn't use the word free. And since this was a new term, they had the chance to decide which ideas to associate with it. They chose to omit the entire ethical level. What is for us the most important part, they left out. So they don't say if a program is not open source, then it's an injustice and you must reject it. Instead, they don't say if you develop software, it's morally incumbent on you to make it open source for the sake of your users. They don't say that it's an issue of right and wrong. They only say, if you write a program, we recommend making it open source, because if you let the users change it and redistribute it, they will make improvements in the code quality. So for them, the deepest value is code quality, which is purely practical convenience. Well, they were the majority in 1998, and the companies in the community went with them, because most of the companies in the free software community also distributed or even developed proprietary software. So this meant, since companies speak with a voice amplified by money, that open source and the associated ideas were what most people heard from then on. And since then, we in the free software movement have worked very hard just to bring our ideas to the attention of the public. The people who started open source, they may have thought that the free software movement would disappear. In fact, they've often given the impression that it did. I encounter people regularly who think that the free software movement was something that existed before open source and was replaced. Well, that's not right. The free software movement is still here. But we need your help in telling people it's still here. Because if people like our software, but they don't think of it in ethical terms, they can easily lose their freedom that we've worked to give them. So you can help us simply by saying free software, or high software, or use the French word in English, you know, the French word libre. Write that in English, too. It'll help point out to people, we're talking about freedom here. It's up to all of us to make sure that thinking about and talking about freedom doesn't die out. It's not enough just to value freedom yourself. You've got to help teach other people about it, and you could only do that by bringing up the issue in terms of freedom when you talk about it. If you keep that to yourself, you're not teaching anyone else. And nowadays, most people who use the GNU/Linux system don't encounter these ideas. They only come across the open source ideas, most of them. And I've even seen articles that called me the father of open source. When I see that, I send a letter to the editor saying, if I am the father of open source, it was conceived through artificial insemination using stolen sperm without my knowledge or consent. Then I continue by explaining what the free software movement stands for, and that's what really brought this community into existence as well as its software. And that's the point. To show the readers of that periodical the ideas of freedom that were missing from the article. So please join in and help us spread these ideas. In the free software community, several times we have achieved freedom and lost it again because most of the people in the community didn't care enough to insist on keeping it. For instance, in 92, when Linux was liberated, GNU plus Linux was a complete free operating system. You could buy a new PC for the first time and run it in freedom by installing GNU/Linux. But it wasn't easy. At the beginning, you had to tinker with it and become an expert to get it to run. So, various people began developing distributions or distros of GNU/Linux to make installation easier. A few years later, there were several distros competing in a community where most people didn't think of the issue in terms of freedom. So the developers of some distros had the idea, we could get more success in this competition by adding some non-free programs to do jobs that free software doesn't do at the moment. And then presenting them to the users as advantages of our distro. Now, a user who was a free software activist would have said, that ruins it. But most users were not. Most users didn't think of it in those terms. They perceived this as added convenience, and those distros gained success. So then the developers of other distros looked at that and said, uh-oh, they're gaining. We have to install non-free software too, so that they don't have an advantage anymore. And over the next few years, all the distros put in non-free software. 10 years ago, when people asked me, where can I get a copy of this system? I had to answer, I'm sorry, but I don't know any place I can recommend. There are dozens of distros, and they all contain non-free software, so they're not ethical. We had reached freedom, and we had fallen back. Because not enough of us insisted on holding on to it. Some of us did, but we were too few to lead the whole community with us. So, this shows how much harm can be done by being weak in insisting on freedom. I'm happy to say that there are now some completely free GNU/Linux distros available. For instance, there is Utudo. U-T-U-T-O. There is BLAG, which stands for BLAG, Linux, and GNU. There is GNUSense, which is also a joke. You see, my job title as the head of the GNU project is the chief GNUsense. Which is spelled as G followed by nuisance. But the distro GNUsense is written as G new sense. So it's another joke. And there is also Triskel and Dragorda and Benenux and a few more. The list of them is in gnu.org/distros. But as I'm sure you can tell, these are not the well-known successful distros. Those continue to contain or steer people towards non-free software. So we have begun to recover the freedom that we lost, but only begun. We've got a long way to go to reach the point where anyone installing GNU/Linux will be installing only free software. And then we lost our freedom in another way. Non-free pieces got put into Linux, the kernel. Torvalds made this decision to put pieces of non-free code called binary blobs into Linux. The way they appear is as long tables of numbers in a supposed source file, but the table is really an executable program dressed up as source code. And representing an executable program as a list of numbers does not make real source code. The real source for those programs is not available. And many of them carry explicit non-free licenses. These programs are typically firmware. That is, they don't run on the central processor. They run in some other processor. But you can't ignore the fact that they're in your system. It's the system that has them and that copies them into the other processor at startup. So you have this non-free software installed in your system. And we can't use that. So we have to fix the problem. The way we fix it is by maintaining a modified version of Linux, which we call Linux Libre. And it's done very simply. We have a script that finds the blobs and deletes them. So every time Torvalds releases a new version of not totally free Linux, we run the deblobber script and make a corresponding new version of Linux Libre. It's not much work, and it produces a kernel that's entirely free software, so we can distribute it. What this fails to achieve is to replace those non-free programs. You see, those pieces of firmware are needed for certain I/O devices, certain peripherals, and those peripherals just don't work in the free world. You can't use them and have freedom. There are two ways to respond to that fact. Torvalds' way is put in non-free software, don't talk about it much, and give people the feeling that it's okay and they can use those devices. They don't realize they're using non-free programs to do it. And then our way is simply to acknowledge those peripherals don't work in the free world. We can't support them until someone writes the free software to do it. Now, if you want to make a tremendously important contribution by programming, do reverse engineering of some important device. So, as you can see, it's easy to lose your freedom if you don't care about it. If we put freedom into somebody's hand and he doesn't appreciate it as freedom, he won't know he should close his hand and hold on to it, and he'll lose it. So, if we want to establish lasting freedom, it's not enough just to write free software. We have to teach the users to appreciate the freedom it gives them. And that's why we need your help spreading these ideas. If you want to help the GNU project and the free software movement, take a look at gnu.org/help. You'll see a list of many ways you can help. Some of them involve programming, and some of them don't. New issues, new threats to our freedom arise from time to time. Nowadays, you can run non-free software on your computer without even knowing it. Many web pages come with non-free JavaScript programs that get installed into your browser. They don't even tell you they're doing so, and you're running non-free software on your computer. The only way to stop that, until a few months ago, was to keep JavaScript deactivated. But now there's a better way, with the LibreJS program. This program is an add-on to Firefox. What it does is it analyzes the JavaScript programs that pages try to run. It checks whether they are non-trivial, and it checks for free licenses. If they are non-trivial and non-free, it blocks them and it warns you. And it has a heuristic complaint feature. It searches the site to find how to send a complaint and invites you to send one. Please install LibreJS and please send complaints. And by the way, it is ethically acceptable to run the non-free JavaScript in order to send the complaint for that purpose. Just as it was ethically legitimate to use Unix to develop GNU, which would replace Unix and eliminate the need to use Unix, so it's ethically acceptable to run that non-free JavaScript to send the complaint to get them to free it or take it out. But there's another way to lose control of your computing nowadays. You don't even have to run a non-free program yourself to lose control of your computing. All you have to do is let someone else do it for you on his computer. This is known as software as a service. And it's always a mistake to use it. We also call it SaaS, which is why we make buttons that say, "Don't SaaS me." Software as a service means, instead of doing your computing by running a program in your computer, you send all the relevant data to someone else's computer where his choice of software runs and does your computing, and you can't either see or touch those programs, and you have no control at all over how your computing gets done, and then it sends you the result or it takes action on your behalf. So, this way you lose control of your computing just as if you ran a non-free program, but the mechanism is different. You aren't running a non-free program. You're losing control of your computing in a different way. But actually, it's even worse than that. I explained how some non-free programs have surveillance features. They transmit information about the use of the computer to some server. Well, with software as a service, the user has to send all the relevant data to the server. And that's the same outcome. There's a server which has this user's data, and who knows what the server is going to do with that data afterwards. But it's even worse than that. As I explained before, there are non-free programs that have universal backdoors that allow remote installation of software changes. In other words, somebody can remotely change how the user's computing gets done without asking the user's permission. But if the user is using SaaS, the operator of the server, of course, can install different software and should be able to. It's his computer. He should be able to control what software runs in it. But when he changes that software or puts in other software, additional software, he changes how the user's computing gets done without asking the user's permission. So SaaS is inherently equivalent to running a non-free program with surveillance features and a universal backdoor. In other words, it's equivalent to running proprietary malware. So you've got to say no to it. Fortunately, SaaS is unusual. If we look at all the world's websites, most of them just publish information. They don't offer to do your computing for you. Looking at that information is not SaaS. The issues don't arise. But if we consider the ones that are non-trivial services, well, only a few of them are SaaS. Most of them do some kind of communication. In other words, they invite you to participate in computing which is not particularly yours. So it's a different kind of issue. But there are some which really are SaaS. The clearest example is translation services. What they do is the user sends them some text and says, translate it from this language to this language, and the server sends back the answer. Well, that's doing the user's own computing, computing that the user could do with the appropriate program in her own computer. And that's the criterion for SaaS. If it's doing a job that, in principle, you could do by running the appropriate program in your own computer, then it's SaaS. And you should do that job only by running free software in your own computer and not by letting some company service do it for you. So, my last topic is free software and education. Educational activities, including all schools of all levels, must teach exclusively free software. There are four reasons for this. The most superficial, the least important, so the one I'll mention first, is to save money. Now, free software is not necessarily costless, but it does provide users the opportunity to save money if they want to make an effort. For instance, if the Ministry of Education has one copy of a free program, it can make a copy for every school and distribute them to the schools using Freedom 2. Then the school can install that program in every computer and run it using Freedom 0. And because they are free to do these things, they're not required to pay to do these things, so they can arrange to save money. It's good if schools save money, they don't have enough money. But this is a superficial secondary benefit. So you, above all, you should make sure not to bring this out last as if this were what we're really supposed to convince somebody. No, make sure it's clear that this is a secondary benefit. And besides, some proprietary developers eliminate the possibility of savings by donating gratis copies of their proprietary software to schools. How nice of them, how altruistic. Then they take a tax deduction for the imaginary theoretical value, commercial value of those gratis copies that cost them essentially nothing. But that's not the worst part of it. The worst part of it is what happens when the schools use those programs. Because the plan here is the developer is trying to use the school as an instrument to impose dependence on society. Here's how it works. The school gets the gratis copies of these non-free programs and teaches the students to use them, and they become dependent. And then they graduate and they're still dependent. And the same developer doesn't offer gratis copies to these former students. Oh no, now they're supposed to pay. And some of them get jobs working for companies. The developer doesn't offer those companies gratis copies. Oh no. So the point is, if the school is cooperative enough to direct its students down the path of dependence, this dependence can last their whole life, and they can pull the rest of society with them into dependence. This is wrong. It's like giving the school gratis needles full of addictive drugs, saying, inject this into your students. The first dose is gratis. The school would reject the drugs, gratis or no, and the school must reject the proprietary software, gratis or no, because the school has a social mission, which is to educate good citizens of a strong, capable, independent, cooperating, and free society. In the computing field, this means graduating skilled users of free software ready to take their place in a free society. And then the school must never teach proprietary software because teaching dependence contradicts its social mission. But there's a deeper reason for the education of the best programmers. Some people are natural born programmers. At the age of 10 to 13, they become fascinated with computing. And if they use a program, they want to know, how does it do this? But when these kids ask the teacher, how does it do this? If the program is proprietary, the teacher has to say, I'm sorry, it's a secret we can't find out. So education is not allowed. A proprietary program is the enemy of the spirit of education, so it must not be tolerated in a school. The teacher can explain as much as he knows and then say, here's the source code, read it and you'll understand everything. And those kids will read it because they're fascinated. And then the teacher can say, if you find any point you can't figure out by yourself, show it to me and we'll figure it out together. This gives our natural born programmer the chance to learn a crucial lesson. That code is not clear. Don't write it that way. How do you develop from a natural-born programmer into a good programmer? What you need to learn is all sorts of ways of writing code that you shouldn't use because they won't be clear to somebody else. And the way you learn that is by coming across them and seeing that they're not clear. How do you learn to write good, clear code? You do it by reading lots of code and writing lots of code. Well, only free software offers the chance to read the code of large programs we really use. Then you have to write lots of code, which means writing code in large programs. But you have to start small. And it's going to take us some more minutes yet, so be warned. So you have to start small, but what does starting small mean? It doesn't mean writing small programs. The challenges of large programs don't even start to appear in small programs. No, the way you start small is by writing small changes in large programs. Only free software gives you the chance to write small or large changes in existing large programs that are really used. So any school can offer the natural born programmers the chance to master the skill, but only if it's a free software school. However, there's an even deeper reason for moral education, education in citizenship. Schools must go beyond teaching facts and skills. They must teach the spirit of goodwill, the habit of helping others. Therefore, every class must have this rule. Students, if you bring software to class, you may not keep it for yourself. You must share it with the rest of the class, including the source code in case someone wants to learn, because this class is a place where we share our knowledge. Therefore, bringing proprietary software to class is not allowed. The school must set a good example by following the same rule. It must bring only free software to class and share copies, including source, with everyone in the class. Those of you who have a relationship with the school, whether you are students, teachers, staff, or parents, It's your duty to campaign for that school to get rid of non-free software. I recommend that you do this, always raising it as a moral issue and always trying to present the issue to more people. That's the way you find more allies. And the willingness to make a personal sacrifice is essential. For instance, if you, in the first meeting of a class, say, will you ask us to use any software that isn't free? And if the teacher says yes, then say, my conscience will not allow me to do that. Can we please work out a way I can do the work using free software? And I don't mind if it takes me extra time to do it that way, because then my conscience will be happy with me. And this willingness to take extra time is crucial. It means you're willing to make a sacrifice. It means you're not trying to look for an excuse to get out of some work. You're willing to do more work because that's what freedom calls for. For more information, look at GNU.org. That's the website of the GNU system and the free software movement. There is also the Free Software Foundation at fsf.org, where you can find resources and political campaigns. Please participate in the campaigns. You can also become a member of the FSF. You can do it through the site, or you can do it here if you wish to pay your membership dues in cash. Just come up to me, I'll give you a card to fill out. There is also the Free Software Foundation Europe, which sends some people here to maintain a table. That's at fsfe.org, and you can also join that organization. They may be able to let you do it paying cash. Now it's time to present my other identity.
Yes.
Saint Ignatius of the Church of Emacs. I bless your computer, my child. Emacs started out as a program, an extensible text editor that I wrote, which gradually developed into a way of life for many users. As they could do all, it was extended so much they could do all their computing inside Emacs. And then it became a church with the launch of the news group alt.religion.emacs, which you might find amusing to visit. Today in the Church of Emacs, we have no services, only software. We have a great schism between several rival versions of Emacs. And we also have saints, but fortunately no gods. Instead of gods, we adore the one true editor, Emacs. To be a member of the Church of Emacs, you must pronounce the confession of the faith. You must say, there is no system but GNU, and Linux is one of its kernels. Become a true expert, you can celebrate that with our ceremony, the Fubar Mitzvah, in which you chant part of our sacred scriptures, that is to say, the system source code. Then we have the cult of the Virgin of Emacs. That refers to anyone who has never used Emacs. And according to the Church of Emacs, offering the virgin the opportunity to lose Emacs virginity is a blessed act. We also have the Emacs pilgrimage, which consists of invoking all the commands of Emacs in alphabetical order. There is a Tibetan sect that claims that it's sufficient to execute them automatically under the control of a script. However, the mainstream church believes that in order to get spiritual merit from this pilgrimage, you have to type them by hand. The Church of Emacs has certain advantages compared with other churches I won't name. For instance, to be a saint in the Church of Emacs does not require celibacy. But it does require living a life of moral purity. You must exorcise whatever evil proprietary operating systems have possessed computers under your control or set up for your regular use, and then install a wholly free operating system. And then only use and install free software with and on the system. If you make this vow and you live by it, then you too will have the right to wear a halo, if you can find one, because they don't make them anymore. People have sometimes asked whether it is a sin in the Church of Emacs to use the other editor, VI. It's true that VI is the editor of the beast. However, using a free implementation of VI is not a sin, it's a penance. And people have sometimes asked whether my halo is really an old computer disk. This is no computer disk, this is my halo. But it was a computer disk in a previous life. So thank you. Time for the auction, you see. The auction of the adorable GNU. This is an adorable GNU that needs a home. So I'm going to auction it on behalf of the Free Software Foundation. And if you buy it, I'll be happy to sign it for you. Sign either this label or the tag. And if you have a penguin at home, you need to get a GNU for your penguin, because as we all know, a penguin can't hardly function without a GNU. Those of you who are leaving, don't forget to take stickers from the FSFE stand and also buy FSF gear. In any case, we can accept payment either in cash or with credit cards, and when you bid, please wave your arm and shout the amount, because you want me to notice. I'm going to start with the usual price, which is 20 euros. Do I get 20? How much?
Yeah, 20.
Okay, I've got 20.
Don't have mail.
25? Who said that? I've got 25. Do I get 30? How much?
35.
I've got 35. Do I get 40? How much?
40.
I've got 40. Do I get 45? How much?
50.
I've got 50. Do I get 55? I've got
60.
How much?
60.
I've got 60. Do I get 65? How much? I've got 70. Do I get 75? I've got 70. Do I get 75? Do I get 75 for this?
75.
I've got 75. How much? 90. I've got 90. I've got 90. Do I get 95? I've got 90. Do I get 95 for this adorable? 95 to the Free Software Foundation to defend freedom. Do I get 95? Do I get 95? Does somebody want to make him pay more? Do I get 95? Last chance. Last chance to bid 95 or more. Going.
95.
I've got 95. Do I get 100?
Yeah.
Do I get 105? I've got 100. Do I get 105? Sorry, do I get 110? It's time to advance. I've got 100. Do I get 110 for this adorable? 110 to the Free Software Foundation to defend freedom. Last chance. Do I get 110 or more? Do I get 110? Last chance. Going. Gone for 100.
Which is not true, because after a short break, like 15 minutes, he will be available to answer questions and discussions.
Why can't I start answering questions now? Do you need me to do some other thing?
It has a very simple reason. There are two overflow rooms which are full, and I want to give them a chance to come in here. And some of you will give a chance to go out if you want. Otherwise, it's been like for the people in the overflow rooms. So I have three things to say. One is, I have to say the sponsors who made this possible, which is Ohlsager and the Sonderforschungsbereich 912. The other thing is, that from now the student exhibitions, student projects are starting all over the building. So please take the chance to look at what our students do. And the last thing that I have to say is thank you to Richard Stallman, and it's been an inspiring talk.
Ich habe mich nicht mehr gemerkt. Ich habe mich nicht mehr gemerkt.